Hey, welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I'm Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
That took all the energy I have to open the show. I'm going to take a nap.
The ball is up in the air. The game is underway. Here we go.
I don't have a choice. I can't go back now. Although, I guess what you don't see at home was me pressing the record button and then sitting there silently for a good 30 seconds while I was trying to remember how to start the show.
Well, we did take it last week off for the holidays.
Still, though, this should be like riding a bike. I don't know that I would remember how to do that, honestly. I don't know. I have enough injuries from riding bikes and things like that along the years, and particularly riding bikes in flip-flops.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Nah, you get the occasional, like, yeah. No, I had a bad incident on the boardwalk in Newport Beach where I grew up, where we used to do this trick where you'd be riding your bike along the boardwalk, and it's basically this stretch of sidewalk. It's this little miniature two-lane road that cars aren't allowed on, but there are street lights and there are signs. And the fun trick was you would act like you were riding no-handed, and you would stand up on the bike and act like you hit your face on the sign, except you'd hit your hand on the sign. Well, one time I hit my hand on the sign and got all squirrely on the bike and wound up riding into the sand and bleeding everywhere. And it was the 4th of July. I mean, that's not surprising to anybody that knows me, really.
No, although it doesn't sound like the smartest thing to do while you're standing on a bike.
No, riding no hand, standing up, acting like you're going to hit your hand on or face on a sign. No, not at all. So, yeah, but a lot going on here in the world of sports. You and I had a basketball game last night. The Bedford Men's Basketball League is in full swing.
Yes, it is.
So a couple competitive games last night where we try to figure out our team.
Now that we have a man down, we lost one of our players to a torn ACL.
Yep.
And injuries is going to be one of the themes of our program today, because we're going to have Jeff Mossow on, the Bedford High pitcher now at St. John's. We're going to talk about his elbow injury. And once we talk about the NFL playoffs, we may talk a little bit about Andrew Luck's comeback from injury. But yeah, we're changing it up on the fly and dealing with the change to the roster.
That's what you got to do. It's like you have a trading deadline. You have to acquire new players, particularly if you had an injury. The Dodgers last year wound up, Corey Seager got hurt. Manny Machado came in. Of course, the Dodgers aren't going to re-sign him. And the question at this point is, who will? Like, who has the money and who has the desire to take the guy on? And I don't know. That's one that I haven't been following. But
I did see a funny reference to that topic.
Yes.
In a ESPN article about the update of the hot stove report for this winter, and that whoever signs Machado and Harper will instantly add 5 wins to next year's total. I mean, that's what they're predicting as
really
their impact on the team.
Okay.
He said, but the Dodgers will easily replace that with Seager coming back.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And then some. Seager is a guy who is completely without any headaches. Hits the ball well. He's a gap-to-gap guy, occasional home runs. I think he's an upgrade on defense from Machado. So you have Seager basically taking over, and he's still on a very affordable contract, at least by Major League Baseball standards. So
does he run hard to first on ground balls?
He runs hard to first. Even he may not be Johnny Hustle.
Well, I mean, who could expect the shortstop of the Dodgers to be Johnny Hustle?
I didn't even know Johnny Hustle was a thing. I thought it was Charlie. But anyway, I digress, as this whole thing is. But we're recording this on Friday morning. You're maybe listening to it on Saturday or Sunday or whenever. And the NBA hot topic is currently, dude's hot, and 6-0 with Chris Paul down. James Harden is having, I don't know that I would go as far as what Daryl Morey said, where he is one of the best offensive players, or he's the best offensive player in the history of the league.
He's in the conversation. You could make an argument for him as the best offensive player ever.
I am challenged by that just solely because Wilt Chamberlain. I think the conversation starts and ends with Wilt. He averaged 50 a game. Like, the conversation starts and ends with Wilt Chamberlain, and it has to. But is, would he be among that next group of people? I mean, he's having a great run, but there are a lot of guys who've had runs like this that are great, but are not historically great.
Well, you know, Wilt, you make a good point there with 50 a game. You know, however, do foul shots count for an offensive player's performance? I think they do because it's scoring. He was not known as a good foul shooter, so he wasn't as efficient as Harden, although he had a very high shooting percentage.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of his offensive prowess came from his physical dominance in a different era, and I don't think he would have been as dominant in this era, so I see him a little bit differently than Babe Ruth.
Right, yes.
But I think Harden, you know, I think it's legitimate. I think he's in the conversation, especially for our era, you know, for the last 30 years, I think he's right in that conversation. And if you look at a few of the numbers, they're pretty staggering. In the last 9 games, he's had at least 35 points and 5 assists. No one has ever done that.
Okay.
He's gone 5 straight games with at least 40 points. He's had back-to-back 40-point triple-doubles.
Okay, but how much is scoring up?
Scoring is up, but, you know, he's averaging 33 a game. He's leading the league in scoring, but he's also 5th in assists. And he's
right.
And he's also shooting a high percentage. He's incredible at the foul line. He gets to the foul line an incredible amount, 10 or 11 times a game. And so the thing is, you know, he's not physically dominant like Wilt, but he's so efficient with hitting 3-pointers and free throws and creating all these assists. He's just a dominant offensive force that is, I think he certainly is number one today as the best offensive player.
But how much of that has to do with the way that the game has changed, with spacing on the floor, with, I guess, a bit more laissez-faire defense that you're seeing now? Do you think if you were to take him and put him in the late 80s, how do you think he would fare against the Detroit Pistons team that is absolutely thrashing him?
Well, it's a good point. I think let's compare him to somebody like Allen Iverson. You know, Allen Iverson had the incredible one-on-one moves, the crossover dribbles to get his shots, get his 30 points a game. And I don't see any reason why Harden couldn't do that because he's much bigger than Iverson. So he's much more of a physical specimen that can actually get into the lane with some power, where Iverson was a lot more finesse. You know, if you compare him to way back in the day, like let's say a Jerry West, somebody before the 3-point line, you know, that would certainly detract from his output. But because he is so good with the one-on-one moves and creating space for himself and getting a shot anywhere on the court that he wants, I think he still would have thrived in the 80s and 90s with the more physical game.
And all the more amazing when you think about the fact that he was highly regarded coming out of Arizona State, but I don't think anybody thought this was going to happen at this point. And he's one, he's fun to watch. He's a good ambassador for the game as well. And seemingly he is the throwback to the time that you didn't have to build a roster. He's the time when you could sort of put the team on a guy's back and he just carries them.
Well, that's the thing. You know, we talked here about Chris Paul going out. You know, Rockets weren't even the top 8 at that point. What are they going to do? How are they going to react? But they've reeled off 6 in a row, and he's been playing incredible. He really has put the entire team on his back, and he's vaulted himself right back up to the top of the MVP conversation. And he can carry a team by himself like nobody else in the NBA right now. And the great thing about him is he's got Clint Capella to work with in the middle of the court. And Capella somewhat quietly went for 29 points and 21 rebounds last night. And they're just such a dynamic 1-2 punch in the middle of the court, running a pick and roll with the shooters spread out. You know, even a team as athletic as Golden State can't stop them. And it just says so much about Harden and the Rockets' potential that they can go to Golden State without Chris Paul, without Eric Gordon, be down by 20 in the third quarter and come back and win that game. I mean, I think Harden put his stamp on the MVP this year, where if he stays healthy and keeps putting up similar numbers, I think you have to give it to him.
Well, I mean, he won it last year, too. And the way his coach is talking about it, you would think that he has been an afterthought in the conversation forever.
Well, the thing is, you know, it is true with the NBA MVP voting. It seems like the media kind of picks somebody early and says, all right, it's their turn. You know, that's why LeBron didn't win it for 8 straight years. You know, this year, okay, we're going to go Curry. And, of course, he deserved it when he got his 2. And now it's Harden's turn. No, first, it was Westbrook's turn. Now it's Harden's turn. Now it's Giannis's turn, but maybe not. You know, Harden is saying, hold on here a second. I got something to say about that.
Yeah, so it has been interesting to watch that in the last week or so. And then it seemed like we were talking about this every week last basketball season, Kawhi.
Yeah. The reunion was last night, which was funny. You know, he goes back to San Antonio with his Raptors, and everybody thought that was going to be the story of the night until the classic game at Golden State went to overtime and Harden hit that amazing three-pointer with 1 second left. But, yeah, you know, Kawhi goes back to San Antonio. He hears the boos. He scores the first bucket of the game. You can see the emotion on his face, but the boos continue. And then at the end of the game, after San Antonio has won handily, there is that reunion on the sidelines between Coach Popovich and Kawhi, and it looks pretty warm considering all the commentary in the media in the time since Kawhi left. What did you make of the treatment that the fans gave Kawhi, and then, you know, how Pop reacted to Kawhi being back in the building?
I mean, you already know how I feel about Pop. I would say, if you're talking about guys who are in the conversation as the greatest NBA anything, I would say you'd have a hard time ignoring Greg Popovich as one of the best NBA coaches of all time. He's one who, year after year, I think even now, even though he's got DeMar DeRozan, it still sort of felt like it should be a rebuilding year. And you look and you feel like the Spurs are having a down year. And what have they won, 27 games at this point? So they're still having a good year. Popovich said he felt badly that Kawhi was booed, which you can't control what the fans do. All it takes is one person starting and somebody else is going to join in. But then Popovich says, Kawhi's a high-character guy. We all make decisions in our lives, what we are going to do with our futures, and he has the same right as any of us, so I felt badly, honestly. The only thing that I struggle with is last year when there was the whole will he or won't he play, and is he injured or isn't he injured? Then Popovich, and I'd have to go back and look, but my overwhelming feeling is Pop at that point in time was one saying, dude's under contract. He's got to get on the floor with us.
Exactly. You know, he was saying things like, you know, everybody else is playing. And he was making comments to the media that were sort of questioning Kawhi's commitment and the injury. And he should be out there. You know, LaMarcus Aldridge is out here playing every day. Why isn't Kawhi? And then, of course, he did have the recent comments in the media where he said that Kawhi was not a leader in San Antonio. You know, it was Patty Mills. It was Ginobili. And I think he retracted that statement a little bit and maybe said he's upset how it was either not taken out of context, but he just didn't like how it came across. So I think he backtracked on that a little bit. But yeah, that's the problem I have with Coach Popovich in this whole thing, is that he didn't have Kawhi's back last season, and then he sent him as far away as he possibly could. I mean, think about it. You're in San Antonio. Oh, you don't want to be a Spur anymore. Your family's in Southern California. We're going to send you all the way to the Northeast in another country, to Toronto. I mean, I think that says all that needs to be said about, you know, how they took to Kawhi. But I think it goes back to Kawhi being mistreated by the medical staff. He didn't trust them, and I really don't think he's to blame here. I fully understand why he doesn't think they were supporting him. And then once he has questions, he's getting second opinions, they start throwing him under the bus in the media. And that's just not the way you treat your NBA Finals MVP or a guy like that. You know, he's a quiet guy. That's just not how he's going to respond.
Right. It didn't look like, and even now it didn't look like he was comfortable. It always does make me happy when regardless of any water that's under the bridge, it's water under the bridge. And those two guys are adult enough, regardless of things that were said or not said, hey, this thing's over and we're good. I did think it was funny how the fans turn so quickly, though. Danny Green gets introduced, there's cheers, and then immediately
right.
At guard from San Diego State, and it's just boos just start raining down on Kawhi.
Yeah, I thought that was a little disappointing. I mean, he just gave so much to that franchise. But I agree, and you know, we should mark this day down, January 4th, because I am going to give Popovich some credit because of what he said after the game. You know, you said it, where he basically said, I'm disappointed that the fans gave that reception to Kawhi. And then, you know, Pop was certainly welcoming Kawhi on the sideline and talking to him. They were laughing. And so I think Popovich was really mature in this position where he kind of took a step back and showed more appreciation for Kawhi than he had before.
Right, and it's good that soap opera is done. The NBA can be done talking about that. Speaking of the NBA, we as we were talking about the Rockets game and the hot James Harden over the last nine games, the one thing that we didn't mention was reffing that even if it was, and I got to do this, even if it was Johnny and Andy in the BMBL, they would have gotten this call right.
Absolutely.
As much as we give them a hard time. It's funny. Like last night after our game, I don't know, one of their guys goes driving the baseline. I obviously fouled him. I fouled him with my left hand. I had my right hand on the ball. And the first thing I did right after that was put two thumbs up, like, hey, give me a jump ball. And Johnny and Andy started laughing at me.
Right.
But I knew I'd committed a foul. I started laughing at them the second that it happened. The Kevin Durant thing that happened in that Warriors-Rockets game was bizarre.
Unbelievable. I can't remember ever seeing a blown call as bad as that.
I mean, that's bad.
Probably in any sport.
Like, he could have paid rent out of bounds.
He ran along the baseline in the
yellow.
Like,
that was like, people have been in an Airbnb for less time than that.
Seriously, closer to the action.
Right.
I mean, he was over in the yellow paint multiple feet. His feet weren't even on the line. They were in the yellow completely, both of them, running along the baseline. He saves the ball to Curry, and it was at an incredibly important time. It's an overtime tie game, 30 seconds left. Curry hits the jumper. They go up two, and Golden State is going to win the game if that play stands,
yeah,
which
Harden
it did.
Doesn't knock his in.
If Harden doesn't make a miraculous three-pointer with 1 second left in Green and Thompson's face, then Golden State wins that game. And it's a big game. It's a lot for standings. It could mean a lot in terms of seeding down the road. It's a lot for momentum and confidence. And the NBA currently doesn't have a way to review that play.
Well, it's just weird.
Yeah, we looked it up, and there's an article on SB Nation that quotes the league's instant replay guidelines. And the long and the short of it is, if they call out of bounds, then they can go review it. Because this was in the last 2 minutes
right.
of overtime.
Yes.
They can go review it to see if either the player was out of bounds or who was the ball off of. And we see that on almost every NBA game down the stretch. But if they don't call that somebody was out of bounds, they can't go back and review it. Which to me is, first of all, it needs to be changed. I wouldn't be surprised if it is changed because of this.
Because it was so botched?
So botched. But the thing that surprised me is it doesn't jive with the three-point rule, where if somebody is shooting a long shot and the refs aren't sure if he's on the line for a two or he's behind it for a three, the game can go on for a minute and a half. The next time out, they can go back and review it and say, oh, it was a three, and put another point on the board, or say, no, it was a two, and take a point off the board. They can do it later in the game at a break. So yeah. Why can't the refs on the next dead ball in this situation say, we got to go to the monitor, we're in the last 2 minutes, was he out of bounds? Yeah, he was basically almost sitting in the stands, he was so far out of bounds.
Right. It was a completely missed call, and could have had, I mean, in early January, what kind of impact does it really have? Both teams are going to make the playoffs. Chances are, you know, who knows what's going to happen, but chances are it's not going to mean a whole lot. But there still is that, hey, it means something to somebody. It's going to mean something to somebody in Vegas, too.
Yeah, I mean, it it probably would not affect making the playoffs. But still, in the Western Conference, I mean, it's almost never been this tight. Between second place and eighth place, there's a difference of 3.5 games.
Right.
So you lose 2 games, you could go from second to eighth in a heartbeat, in a week. And, you know, it wasn't long ago that Houston was in 14th place.
Yeah.
In the standings. And now they've
had a good run.
They've gone 11-1. They're up to fourth.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's still only 1.5 games in the playoffs. So 2 losses right now, they could technically drop out of the top 8.
Yeah. Which it's been an interesting year over there in the West. So speaking of playoffs.
Playoffs?
Yeah, Patriots fans, it's okay. Your team's in the playoffs. They're just not playing this weekend.
That's a very good thing.
I just want to let people know in case they are deciding to bust out their Gronk or Tom Brady jerseys after
the new year,
putting them on the dog and letting the dog roll around in the backyard for a while, because people were very upset a few weeks ago. Tom Brady was ready for an AARP card. He was done. And now they look good again. But it's wild card weekend. So that's fun, and it's also fun to be able to watch football without really any sort of vested interest. I haven't warned you we're going to do this, but we're going to do this.
Okay.
Indianapolis, Houston. Houston's favored by 3.
I got Indy.
You have Indy?
Yes, sir.
+3.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I got Houston -.
Mark it down.
All right. Seattle, Dallas. Dallas -1.
I got Seattle.
I like Seattle there, too. And I don't know what the total is, but I'd take the under. unless it's set at like 19.
Right, which it wouldn't be.
Yeah, no.
I don't think I've ever seen a line below, 33?
That's about as low as it'll go.
Yeah, but that's probably in the low 40s. But those teams both want to run the ball. So, I could see that going under.
Okay, so you said Seattle?
I said Seattle.
Chargers, Baltimore. The Baltimore Ravens are at home and are a 1-point favorite.
One? I'll still go with the Chargers.
You like the Chargers? I would take the Chargers, too. And then...
You're from Southern California, aren't you?
I am, but... and then last but not least, the Bears and the Eagles. Bears -5.5.
Duh, Bears.
You like the Bears?
You going to go with the Nick Folesians?
Torn.
From Philly?
You know, I do think there's something to be said for Nick Foles' magic. It's weird.
He's won 3 in a row, including at the Rams. He's their Super Bowl magic man from last year.
Yeah, Nick Foles is playing well, so we will see what happens. And then,
what's at stake here? Some push-ups in the studio?
Dunkin's. Coffee. I could use that right about now. So,
I found an interesting stat this week about...
My coffee consumption? Yes.
No, about wild card weekend road underdogs by less than 3 points.
Okay.
So that is the Chargers, Seattle, and Indianapolis.
Is it less than 3 or 3 or fewer?
Not that
really matters.
I think it was less than 3.
And keep going.
All of these lines have been going between 1 and 3. So
yes.
They all, at some point, qualified for this statistic. I don't remember the exact numbers, but in the last 10 years, those teams cover like 75% of the time.
Well, and for those who don't know, the mere fact of playing at home gets you 3 points.
Right.
And that's, you know, and it gives or takes. But the mere fact that you're playing at home gives you 3 points. So in a lot of cases, the teams that are... 1-point underdog playing on the road, or a 2-point or 3-point underdog playing on the road, somebody looks at it and says, this team is favored to win the game.
They're the better team on a neutral field.
They're the better team on a neutral field. And then that sort of begs the question, is home field advantage in the playoffs really that big of a deal? Like, when you get into certain situations, it may look like it's, and this is a question for further analysis, but when you get into a situation later in the playoffs where you have the Patriots playing against the Jags and the Patriots are hosting a home game, well, the Patriots would have won that game if they were playing it in Jacksonville. They're just going to win by more playing it at home. not to mention when you get later in the playoffs, you have a team that is fresh versus a team that is not. This isn't baseball and this isn't the NBA, where I do think there's a decided advantage to, okay, we're hot, we're going to keep playing. You know, in MLB, you see it time and again. I mean, my perfect case in point is the 2001 Mariners. They clinched that division in like July.
Right.
And
that was when they set the record for wins.
They won, what, 116 games that year. Then they had a mediocre playoff because they had clinched for so long and you're playing meaningless games for so long. Even when you put the starters in, it's like this, you might say, yeah, this is a time that we're going to have our players in the game and focused. But it's hard to turn it on and turn it off versus the guys who are legitimately playing for a spot, or, hey, we just rolled through a 7-game series. We got 2 days off. Now we're right back at it again. There's something to be said for having that real live game speed, game action.
Absolutely.
And so you look at the NFL, though, and you say, well, the NFL doesn't quite work like that because of how banged up these guys get. Like, that's the... To me, the freshness factor is outweighed by the fact that you're just getting beaten up.
Yeah, that's a huge point. And the thing about football is it's a little bit less of a finesse game than baseball, you know, which
slightly.
Is all about timing.
I don't know if you noticed.
You know, and the guys who are used to playing every day, or if you take a couple days off or over the course of like 5 or 6 days, you only play once or twice. It is so much different than football, where you take the week off and physically you're just that much better off. And, you know, the week off from timing doesn't affect you like it does in baseball. The only other thing I would say about home field advantage in football is the weather. You will see it.
Yes, yes.
You know, we've seen year in and year out that late in the season, the Patriots don't go travel to Miami very well when it's 90 degrees. But when people come to New England in December and January, they lose.
And
it's almost automatic. And so teams that have to go to the cold weather, outdoor stadium, I think that's an advantage.
And it also does depend, too. Where did a guy go to college? Is he used to playing a cold weather game versus is this a completely strange thing to him that he played down in the SEC, particularly with a quarterback, guy who played down in the SEC who now all of a sudden, instead of throwing the ball with barehanded, he's now wearing gloves. And he's got to do that because he's just not used to being in cold weather, not used to snow. That can be a challenge. Tom Brady playing up here, well, where did he play his college ball? Michigan. Like, this is a guy who's a California guy, but he also had ample time up where it's cold like it is here. So he's no stranger to that.
Yeah, and you think about a team like Chicago hosting Philadelphia. They're not going to have that home field advantage because Philly is used to playing in the cold. Whereas you rewind to that primetime game where the Rams came to Chicago and it was cold and windy and the defense was tough and the Rams just looked pathetic. And so it's going to be real fun to see, you know, these different matchups and where they take place. One of the matchups this weekend that's going to be in normal conditions down in Houston is the one I'm most excited about. When Indy goes down to Houston, what I'm excited about is watching Andrew Luck in primetime because he's had this incredible season. He missed all last year with the shoulder injury, comes back, slowly builds up his strength and gets back in the groove. And he's just had an outstanding season that I think has gone under the radar. And that's why I'm looking forward to seeing him. But if you look at some of the numbers, I mean, we all know that Mahomes has had this incredible season, but Luck has, let's see here, 47 more completions than Mahomes, slightly better completion percentage. Luck has about 601 more yards passing than Drew Brees this year. He's got more touchdowns than Rivers and Brees. Only Mahomes has more touchdowns. So, you know, there was that stretch where he had 3 touchdowns a game for like 8 games in a row, and I just don't think he's gotten the notoriety. And it'll be really exciting if he can, with Reich at the helm, make a run here and we finally see Andrew Luck play to his potential in the playoffs.
Well, Frank Reich, too, is Captain Comeback. I mean, that's...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
The comeback in college, playing for Maryland, the comeback for the Bills. the comeback last year in the Super Bowl, of course. So, I mean, he's got a track record.
And like, the team comeback this year, they were 1-5.
They were brutal. Yeah.
1-5, third team ever to start 1-5 and make the NFL playoffs.
Yeah.
It's a great story.
So that will be interesting to see. The what would you like? Dallas, Seattle, total set up 43.
And I'll go under that.
Yeah, I'd take under 43. I'm all right with that. I mean, it's higher than I would have expected it to be, which makes me believe that there's something that somebody knows that I don't.
I think it has something to do with a guy named Russell Wilson.
Yeah.
Who just finds his way into the end zone. And
Dallas has been playing some good D.
They have been playing some good D, right?
So I'm curious there. Speaking of, we touched on Michigan a little bit. The Rose Bowl was Ohio State's last game with Urban Meyer. And then that sort of begs the question, because he retires as much as Michael Jordan. Like, it's like Brett Favre, Michael Jordan, Urban Meyer, the guys who retire and then come back. Do you think he's done?
Well, Tom Rinaldi asked him that on the field, if I remember correctly, and he gave an answer that I don't think he said it's impossible.
Yeah.
I would probably, if I had to predict, I'd say he's done. You know, he goes out with a Rose Bowl win. Apparently, he's going to take some job in the administration, be an assistant to the athletic director. And so if he just sort of settles in, I could see him...
assistant to the assistant manager of the movie theater. Yes.
I could see him settling in. You know, apparently he wants to be a part of the OSU culture and stay there. I think I saw something that his wife really wants him to be done coaching.
Yeah, no, so, that was... And...
What do you think? Is he done?
I would say it's hard for him to get back in, particularly...
Meaning because no one would want to give him a job?
No, anybody who would want a job, I think he might have a hard time, more than anything, convincing his wife that, hey, this is a good thing. I also think and I'm not going to say his tenure has been beset by scandal, because it hasn't. This year has.
They've been through a lot this year.
With the whole thing with Zach Smith, you put that into the crucible of this year and the things that he's had to deal with, and you almost kind of have him thinking, is it even worth it for me to continue to do this? Like, he's got a ton of money in the bank. He's got a legacy. Like, there's no doubt he has been in the handful of most successful college football coaches of all time. Of course, there's another guy still coaching who I would say, or guys that I would say have been more successful.
Somebody who's going to be playing on Monday night.
Yeah, Saban and Dabo Swinney have both been very successful, but and I would say you'd really have a hard time making an argument against Saban as the best college football coach of all time.
Yeah, I mean, his resume, I don't know how you outdo that.
Yeah, so Meyer, even if that was his career goal, I don't know that he would have the ability to get there. And it might just be that, hey, this is the realization that I'm not going to get there, and that's okay. It's always interesting to me, too, to look at Urban Meyer, who you knew he played minor league ball.
No, I don't think
he played. He played minor league baseball in the early 80s for the Braves. Never got above rookie ball, and career average 182. Not that, hey, playing minor league baseball is an accomplishment in and of itself. The thing that surprises me is knowing what we know about him now, and how competitive he is, and how focused, and how much of a truly a grinder he is. It surprises me that a guy like that wouldn't have been able to grind himself into
230, 240,
advancing somewhere slightly higher.
Right.
And it almost makes you wonder if, like, hey, this was a nice thing that he was doing, that, and then it sort of morphed into, well, I'm not going to do this. I'm just going to go to college and play football. So,
is that what he did? Did he play college football after that?
He played college football after that. He was drafted when he was 18 and went and played in the Gulf Coast League, and then played in the Appalachian League. And I don't know, honestly, I don't know if that was more of a summer gig, like a Russell Wilson type thing, speaking of. or if that was a, hey, I made this decision after the fact, but truly a very competitive, very intense guy. Ohio State, though, is led by a UNH guy now, Ryan Day, a Manchester guy.
And he may have a new quarterback next year.
And it looks like he's going to have Georgia quarterback Justin Fields, who spent more time on camera, I think, than Georgia's quarterback did during the game the other night, because it was kind of this will he or won't he of Fields isn't going to transfer. He's been reassuring everybody that he's not going to transfer. Well, that game wasn't long ago. It was 3 days ago. He's already cleared out his dorm room. So
there you go.
Apparently, he'd made up his mind. He was just going through the motions. He's going to Ohio State. So, which is interesting. Dwayne Haskins, who was the Heisman Trophy finalist for the Buckeyes. Haskins is most likely leaving to go to the NFL. Justin
but he
Fields,
hasn't declared yet, correct?
He has not declared yet. But Justin Fields, who is entering his sophomore season, will come right into Ohio State. Ryan Day's got himself a guy who was the number one player in the 2018 class. So interesting to see that and to see the Chip Kelly coaching tree continuing to manifest itself. It's pretty crazy.
Yes, it is.
So Kelly, of course, still at UCLA. Did you see Steve Alford?
Gone.
Well, you can't lose to Liberty and Belmont at home.
Not if you're a UCLA Bruin, you can't.
No, and not if you're really anybody, can you? But the they made mention of it on ESPN this morning. Pac-12 refers to itself as the College of Champions. And the Pac-12 has won more championships in all sports than any other conference. I say this as a Pac-12 alum. But, boy, are we bad in football and basketball.
Yeah, it's not.
Just atrocious.
Not the golden age.
Embarrassing.
Currently.
The Pac-12 will likely send one team to the NCAA tournament.
Where's John Wooden when you need him?
Spinning. Fast. Talking to Bill Walton.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the other segment was Bill Walton, who, of course, played basketball at UCLA, was talking to the statue of John Wood. as only Bill Walton can.
He's one of a kind. That was a fun interview.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that.
Yeah. So anyway, we will take a quick break. We're going to come right back with Jeff Mossow, who graduated from Bedford High less than a year ago and has endured a handful of medical issues along the way, is now at St. John's. But Andrew had the opportunity to catch up with him a few days ago. He graciously agreed to join us on the show. So take a quick break and come right back. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox.
Andrew Hansen.
And we are joined by Bedford High, I guess, recent alum would be the best way to put it, Jeff Mossow, who is at St. John's, however, was slated to pitch on the baseball team in the spring. We'll get to some of the reasons why he will not be pitching in the spring in a little bit. But, Jeff, you're home for winter break from your freshman year at St. John's. How has college been so far?
So far, college has been awesome. Fortunate enough to have a really good training staff and a really good coaching staff at school. And my teammates have been great. They welcomed all the freshmen in very open-heartedly, and it's been awesome so far.
That's great to hear. And I'm guessing you mentioned the training staff in part because obviously you're dealing with an injury, and the plans for your freshman year haven't gone quite as planned after your stellar senior year at Bedford when you were named first-team All-State as a pitcher. You had an injury this summer, so tell us about that and how it happened.
So I was feeling a little bit of elbow pain in the winter. I didn't think it was anything too serious. I just thought it was tightness. And then it started to get worse and snowball a little bit. And so the back end of my senior year, and then I took a little bit of time off before I joined the Nashville Silver Knights. And started on July 28th, I started against the Martha's Vineyard Sharks, and then I just felt it go on one pitch. And ended up tearing my UCL and having to get Tommy John surgery.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't know that you'd been dealing with some elbow soreness through the spring. So you had some consistent soreness in your senior year, but then you had this one pitch where you sort of, was it that you heard a pop or you felt something?
I didn't really feel a pop. but I definitely felt a really big tug is what I how kind of how I describe it. But yeah, I something was wrong, so I took myself out of the game after that and got checked out by the trainer, and we decided that I should go ahead and get an MRI and meet with Dr. O down at Mass General, and he diagnosed it as a torn UCL.
And so then we understand that you went ahead and had the Tommy John surgery this summer. So what has your rehab process been like since then?
It's been all right. Some days are tougher than others. I've been in the training room about 4 or 5 times a week, and then working with the special PTs about 2 times a week. But so far it's going smoothly, and I just started to throw again, kind of almost a month in, and it's felt awesome so far.
That's great to hear that you're throwing again. So where are you sort of in, you know, throwing strength in terms of trying to get back towards 100%?
So right now I'm on an interval throwing program, which means just working my way out. Right now I'm at 90 feet, about 50 throws, and then it gets more throws at 90 feet, and then I stretch it out a little more to 120, then 150 to 180, and then I'll return back to the mound around April, May time. And then I should be on track to pitch in a game again in maybe late July, but definitely targeting my comeback as September.
So, yeah, that sort of makes sense with what we all understand the timeline to usually be for Tommy John of approximately a year. And you mentioned kind of pushing through it and the mental side of this. You know, how are you dealing with this mentally and, you know, are you thinking about certain things as you're going through this rehab multiple times per week to try to motivate you to get back on the mound?
Being away from the mound is not fun, especially going to a school like St. John's where all the pitchers are at the next level and they're really good. It's definitely hard. It takes a little bit away from I'm not able to compete, kind of earn my spot at St. John's. But I'm fortunate enough to have the best teammates in the world, and there's some guys on the team that have gone through it, and they help me push through it every day. And any questions I have, they answer it. So it helps a lot mentally there.
That is great. And now that you're in the thick of it, you know, we're wondering about any advice you have for others, because we've got a teammate on our basketball team who just tore his ACL. So he's facing a long rehab.
Not quite. Not as long, though. The UCL is special. I mean, in ACL, you can be back from at full strength 4 or 5 months, depending. The UCL is one it's a long process, and it's one that anytime you talk to anybody, and Hanson played pro ball, and I broadcast in pro ball for some time, you talk to guys who are coming back from it, it's a lot like a microcosm of life. Like sometimes things go great, and then then all of a sudden you have a setback, and you say, all right, how do I build back up to where I was again? So for you, a few months in, what advice would you give to others in the process?
To definitely not rush it. That's kind of something I did in the beginning, was I was so anxious to get my arm brace off and to start doing baseball activities again. But just to take it slow in the beginning, because it's going to work wonders in the long run. And then just stay consistent. You can't really take any days off with ACL, UCL surgery. Which I never really took any days off, but I could definitely tell if I was a little bit, I rested for a little bit too long, it would get too tight, and then it would get really uncomfortable. So that's definitely some of the advice I'd give.
We're joined by Jeff Mosso, the standout pitcher for Bedford last spring, now at St. John's, going through the rehab process. And when you talk about advice for others, and that's great to hear, and then we're also curious about advice you've gotten about your particular situation. And as you're going through this process, you're talking to doctors, you're talking to teammates, is there anything that you're going to do in the future with your training, your workouts, your arm, your elbow, to try and make sure that you don't have an injury like this in the future?
Definitely going to work on my shoulder strength a lot more. My shoulder strength in my left arm was a little bit weak, and that may have been one of the reasons why I got Tommy John surgery, but definitely a lot more working on my arm after, definitely taking care of it more, getting it worked on by the PT at school will definitely help prevent the surgery again, and then to stay healthy and throw harder and harder as I get older.
Yeah, we sure hope that it comes out like that for you and you're stronger than ever. So when you first get out there with your St. John's teammates, let's talk a little bit about the program. They came off another trip to the NCAA Division I Baseball Regional last spring. Tell us about your coach and the successful program that he has built there.
Coach Blankmeyer, he's definitely the best coach I've ever had. He really understands what it takes for a player to develop and what it takes for that player to get to the next level. He definitely really knows how to win. He got a lot of wins in the past couple of years. He understands the process with my elbow. He understands everything that a college student is going through because he's been around for a long time. He's definitely the best resource I could have. I wouldn't want it any other way.
That's great to hear that he's been through it and he understands it. So he's perfectly comfortable being patient with you and understanding that it's going to be a long process and he's not putting any pressure on you to get back sooner than you'd be comfortable. He's fully supportive of you in that way.
Exactly. Yep.
That's great to hear. Now, one other thing about the program is I noticed when you're working out that St. John's t-shirt you had with the phrase 54 outs on it. So how does everyone on the team talk about 54 outs at St. John's?
To us, that just means that we got to play a complete game, stay locked in every inning, even if we're up big and even if we're down by a lot. We just got to play a complete game, give it all you got for all 54 outs of the game. And then if we stay locked in for all 54 outs, good things are going to happen. So that's kind of the motto we go by at St. John's.
Makes perfect sense. And it's, usually people think of it along the lines of 27 outs. Like all we have to do is get 27 outs. But what he's trying to do is say, okay, on both sides, whether we're hitting, whether we're on defense, it's you want to finish the game.
Yep. Yep. That's exactly what you got to pitch and play defense. I pitch and hit.
Yep.
It's kind of what we work on every day.
So we are joined by Jeff Mosso, the ace of the Bedford High staff last year, who is now at St. John's, and your brother Avery will be playing baseball at St. A's, but he's still got one more year at Bedford High School. Is he ready to follow in your footsteps on the staff this spring?
Yeah, he's been working extremely hard this offseason, battling through a little bit of injury on his hips, but I don't think it's anything serious. He'll be one to watch this year. He's going to be really good.
And it should be a lot of fun for you, too, at the end of the season. Hopefully, they're still in the middle of their playoff hunt, and you're back from school. You can come back and cheer them on.
Yep. I'm hoping that's the case, so I get to watch them play for one more year in high school.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate the time. Thank you for joining us, and best of luck the rest of the year at school and of course, with the rehab, too.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Take care, Jeff.
You, too.
That was Bedford High grad, recent grad, Jeff Mosso. And you've seen him at the gym, so of course you know a lot of his past experience from seeing him there. I have to imagine, though, it's pretty tough, and it seems like he's dealing with it very well, just kind of dealing with the injury and the rehab pieces of it.
Well, the thing that really surprised me is that I saw him at the gym this summer after he had sustained the injury. And at that point, he actually didn't know yet for sure what the extent of the injury was. So he didn't know if he'd have to have Tommy John. Next thing I know, I think I talked to Avery and found out that he indeed had the Tommy John. But again, that was like mid to the end of the summer. And then I saw him last week at the gym and he's doing these rows with some pretty decent weight. And I was just surprised that he was, you know, that far advanced in his recovery to be lifting, you know, substantial weights and to hear him say that he's throwing at 90 feet. It's just great. You know, it seems like he's a little bit ahead of schedule and it's just such a tough way to start off your career in college. I mean, you know, he's playing in a high profile summer league, gets this devastating injury for a pitcher. And he's, you know, thought for years about taking the jump to the next level, playing Division I baseball, and he's got to sit on the sidelines for a year.
Yeah, I have to imagine that's difficult. And then the other, I guess, there are a few things at play. First of all, back in the day, Tommy John surgery was for a lot of pitchers, I mean, it was a career ender back in the of course, before Tommy John surgery, it was obviously a career ender. You think about guys like Sandy Koufax and others. And Tommy John had it done in 1974 and used to joke about his arm being old enough to have a bar mitzvah when he was still pitching in the 80s. He was truly a pioneer. And here we go. If Harold Baines is going to be in the Hall of Fame, I think Tommy John deserves to be in the Hall of Fame as well for the lasting contributions that he's made to the game. But aside from that, I look back to even 10, 15 years ago, the arduous rehab that a guy would have to undergo to overcome Tommy John and the work that he had to do to get back. And the rehab is still difficult, but every day orthopedic surgeons and physical therapists are learning more about what it takes to bring a guy back from Tommy John and ensure that not only does he not lose velocity, but that he gains velocity after the surgery. So it's almost, in a lot of ways, it's become a rite of passage for a lot of these guys.
Yeah, it really has. And he's fortunate to have the medical advances that are in place now and to have people around him who know about it. And his coach is supportive. You know, I actually had surgery in college. After my freshman year, I tore the labrum in my shoulder. And I just did sort of rehab with no surgery for my sophomore year. But then I had surgery my sophomore summer. But the thing about it for me was I didn't have to miss a season in the spring. Right. I with the torn labrum, what I could do was rehab from the summer to the spring. And then my junior year, I was ready to go on opening day. And so that's why I got to tip my cap to Jeff that he's got to, you know, he was there in fall ball this year with St. John's and he's got to sit on the sidelines and watch knowing that he doesn't get to pitch in the spring. And to have it be that full year of rehab, it's just such a mental grind. So, you know, I'm glad it is going so well for him and I'm glad that he's got that environment where they're getting him back on the hill as quickly as possible and they're ready for him in the spring of 2020.
Yeah, and again, for pitchers, though, it has changed from what it was, and the coaches know that, too. The coaches also know that, hey, this is something that we're ultimately going to get what we were expecting out of it. It's just delayed a little bit. And, hey, it's no longer there's no stigma attached to it. It's, hey, you were hurt, you're back, you're good. And there have been enough major league guys who have emerged, and I even minor league guys. I think about a guy that I used to work with in Kansas City named Caleb Balbuena, who had been a low 90s guy, went, had Tommy John, came back, and he's throwing 96, and all of a sudden major league scouts are looking at an indie ball guy and saying, hey, this guy is no longer a roster filler guy. Like, this guy might be a major league prospect. And he went from an indie ball guy to a prospect after Tommy John. That's not a foreign concept at this point. This isn't a strange thing that it happens. So coaches, I think, are more willing to look at a guy who's post-op and say, hey, we're going to do what we can because we know what you could do, and we're confident that you can get back there again. I mean, it's the old adage. You want to keep the customers you got. You want to keep the players you got. Like, because they're known commodities. The evil you know better than the evil you don't.
Yeah, I mean, I feel fortunate to have had the procedures in place and the orthopedic surgeon I got to work with, even when I had my procedure done, which was in the summer of 2000. And, you know, back in the 70s, 80s, whether it was a pitcher with the elbow or a running back with the knee, it was one injury like this and your career is over.
Yes.
So we're both fortunate to have the injuries take place now. And that you're right. You know, Jeff's got a good situation to come back and potentially be throwing even harder.
Yeah. So it will be fun to follow him. I guess I didn't know about the labrum tear that you had from everything that I have heard. And because, I mean, you'd see guys who would come through indie ball after having been big-time prospects. The labrum tear is a severe one with a long rehab that's associated with it as well. So to me, it's surprising that you were able to do it in the summer and come back in the spring.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. And the thing is, you know, when you're a left-handed hitter and it's your right shoulder, it's your front shoulder.
Yeah, you're turning.
And if you let go of your top hand at any point during the swing, like I did, it puts a lot of pressure on that front shoulder. And so for that first spring that I played with the injury and just did the rehab without the surgery, it was just trying to get it back to 80-85% to be able to play. But then I don't know what it is about the labrum specifically, or maybe it was because it was a small tear that, yeah, I was able to have the surgery in the summer and do basically 6 months of rehab. You know, every day you're doing these little exercises with these devices that certainly did not exist back in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
And basically like plyometrics for your shoulder. And apparently with the labrum, you know, it's just different. You can get back out there in about 6 months.
It certainly says a lot about the advances that have been made in medicine, particularly sports medicine, that allow these guys to come back. And oftentimes you think about the NBA, we were talking about it earlier, Paul George with the horrific injury a few years ago, and now he's back and getting booed in L.A.
And Gordon
Apparently
Hayward,
NBA fans were just angry this week.
Yeah, seriously. Except in Boston, because Gordon Hayward went from scoring 0 points to scoring 35. And the crowd in Boston just went nuts. That was so much fun to see. I was just looking at the highlights. He saw him make 4 three-pointers as well as 4 dunks, which I think is, you know, more important to him than anything, is to be able to go to the basket with confidence. And it looked like all of his dunks were off of 2 feet. So I think he's, you know, changed his approach at the basket. But still, it was great to finally see him back to what Celtics fans have been envisioning, you know, ever since he came over from Utah.
Yeah, so Hayward is back. That's nice to see. Again, that's like a midseason acquisition. Like, you're picking this guy up, and now he looks like he's back at game speed, and hopefully there will be peace at TD Garden.
That's right.
Yes, we do not need any more. We just need a nice, again, I'm using hand signals. This does no good to anybody. We just need steady, calm waters.
Right. Everybody healthy.
We don't need chop.
Let's see what can happen.
No chop. Calm waters. So with that said, we're going to be done with this week's show. We wanted to take a moment, thank our guest, Jeff Mosso, for joining us, taking time away from his rehab as well as his winter break, and wish him all the best as he gets that ulnar collateral ligament. It's tough to say. Back in full strength. And thanks to everybody here at the station, Harry Kozlowski, Bill Jennings, Colleen Richardson, and Chris Gentry for all their work and taking down the holiday decorations here. Colleen, poor Colleen must have been back and forth the hallway 8-10 times, taking down December. So
2019
Christmas. Now we're on. Calendar page turns, and we'll be back next week. So have a great week. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.